WWPR Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
You initially said you didn't use email for public business, and it turns out you did use private email for that. You initially said Jerry Bailey left voluntarily. It turned out your office forced him. Why should people trust you?
Well, look, I've done the right things. Jerry Bailey, he's left. He did the right thing. It's good for our state. I continue to look for new leadership all the time. I'm going to continue to look for new leadership. I did that in business, and I'm going to continue to do it.
Does your office pressure FDLE to name the previous Orange County Clerk of Courts as a suspect in an investigation?
Absolutely not.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Good morning. It's time for the Morning Edge here on WWPR 1490 AM. Heard Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 9 AM to 10 AM. I'm Henry Raines. Here's Augie.
Good morning, Tampa Bay. We have some technical difficulties this morning, but so does the Republican Party. We have a rebellion going on among the Republican women over the pro-life issues and abortion and all the rest. There was a change in the plans of Mr. Boehner, who has a way of alienating his own people, and these are cross purposes also with the president over the Netanyahu issue in coming and speaking before Congress, and then postponing it for a month into March as opposed to in February. But the technical problems persist, and we're going to go from here. Henry, what's on your
mind? I don't know that it's going to do you any good to have your headset on if you're not getting any volume.
I know.
You just have to take it pure, Augie.
Okay.
Although it will be a little bit of a challenge when Dennis Mealy comes on at 9:30 to talk about Governor Scott and the FDLE there. But, I'm sure we'll struggle through this. How was your weekend?
My weekend, I'm still recovering from the surgery on my left knee, but meniscus has a way of plaguing people between arthritis and that. Party leaders in the Republican Party are facing a real revolt from Republican congresswomen who objected that the legislation did not go far enough.
Are we skipping the headlines?
Well, I guess.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to do that a little bit, but I can go on to.
You already teased the audience. Don't keep them waiting.
Okay, tease the audience, keep them waiting, or don't keep them waiting.
No, I think you should go ahead. I disrupted your role there.
That's all right. Instead of calling a vote on a more limited measure to forbid the use of taxpayer money for abortions, it passed 239-179, with only one Republican voting no. But the tally masked a divide so deep that some conservatives left the Capitol saying they did not know when Congress could take up the issue again on abortion, despite pledges from leaders in both chambers to do so now that Republicans control the House and the Senate. So that's where that's going. And the Elizabeth Warren thing keeps bubbling up. Is she really going to be a contender? And there's that coming forward, Henry. The other issues are Netanyahu and what does that mean? And Krugman saying that Europe is deflating, the dollar is going up even more, and our economy is the most attractive in the Western world, at least. And certainly among nations that are looking to us for leadership. And this president seems to be scandalizing everybody. And Morning Joe this morning, they were talking about just that. Has he so peed off the Republicans, and does it really matter? They were peed off before when he had a majority in the Senate. Now that they have the majorities, what are they going to do about it? What does the election, the midterm election, really mean, and where are things going? The Scott scandal, as you said, is coming up with Dennis Mealy, and well, that's about all I have right at this point, Henry. Dead air here.
The Act Now to Stop War and End Racism Coalition staged a peaceful protest at First Street and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, according to the Bradenton Police Department. At 5:40 p.m. Saturday, a group of about 50 people from ANSWER walked from northbound on First Street to the intersection with Manatee Avenue East, where they blocked First Street East, according to the Bradenton Police Department. Police advised the group of the violation of law, and it moved north to the Riverwalk, met for approximately 1 hour, then moved back to their original starting location. The protest ended at approximately 7:30 p.m. No arrests were made, according to the Bradenton Police Department. So here we are in hometown Bradenton, and we finally are getting the anti-racism, anti-police violence, Ferguson, Michael Brown, New York City chokehold protests.
Well, it's going to happen. It happens all over the country. Do you have a nation, or do we have a bunch of states and regions? And no, the cultural issues all bubble up from all over when they're fundamental to the society. When people are shut out of elections, don't see any point to it. The ghettos that we have basically don't turn out for the elections that benefit them. And what do? They do other things. They blame it on the police. Maybe it's the police's fault. Maybe there's no real relationship with them, no community policing as is recommended so many places. But you're right, Henry. It's Ferguson here, there, and everywhere.
Well, I wonder, ANSWER is, in the groups that are mainstream, ANSWERs are a little bit outside the mainstream, to say the least. But and I saw the organizer speaking on this. He was a white guy that organized this in Bradenton. They all sat down in the middle of the intersection at First Street for I don't know how long, because evidently long enough for the Bradenton Police Department to walk up and say, you got to move on, and then they moved on. So it doesn't sound like anybody was interested in getting arrested or creating a big scene, more like a show the flag kind of operation. And I wonder if anything comes. I didn't see any of the usual suspects of our protests around here in the video on the news.
So this is just a momentary bubble, nothing much of consequence. Well, you know, a year ago about this time, there was a killing of a black kid in a car by a Sarasota deputy and the city police. There was no big upset then. I wonder if that had happened this year or in conjunction with what had been going on at Ferguson and Cleveland and New York and so on, if there would have been that correspondent.
Or why ANSWER picked Bradenton. Not that Bradenton shouldn't have a freedom of expression or voice these issues, but I wonder why they didn't choose Sarasota, since you have an issue at hand right there.
It's ongoing with that police department, and there's real concern in the city to get rid of the police, to eliminate them and just have the policing done by the county sheriff's department.
Well, that may be talk, but there's too many constituencies and too much. Maybe it could be done. I mean, well, it was done in Duval County, but
there's a two-member commission there that would definitely go for it. And if the mayor would, that's a three out of five vote situation.
Sarasota City Commission?
Sarasota City Commission, yes.
Well, they're making a lot of the new police chiefs outreach to Newtown and the big event that was held there this past week, trying to create more connections with the community there in Newtown. And I don't know that the county, unincorporated county, is going to want to pay to police the city.
Well, they would have to give up their budget to do that. They did it with the fire department years ago, and that's well understood in the city commission. They're trying to, the female city police chief, DePino, I think is her name, has been trying to do that several times at Thanksgiving, last Thanksgiving, and other events to make the people see a certain concern among the police. But it's the problem is within the police department of Sarasota itself. The nature of hiring has not been good. The kind of people brought into police in Sarasota have been basically bully boys right out of high school. If you can fit the uniform, you get to wear it. We'll fill out the forms for you. We'll hire you, and we'll say we have police. And you have some guys in there, I'm sure, that are competent. But all in all, the attitude is, let's do it the way we've always done.
You know, you're making those statements about the requirements to join the police department. Why don't you ask a police spokesperson to come on the show and say what their actual requirements are?
We should have her on. You're right. I should have that. I stood with the NAACP and others a couple of years ago on this and said this very sort of thing. Nobody contradicted me, and the black people in Newtown were agreeing. And the NAACP person didn't know where things were, didn't know where she was, or didn't know where to put her hat. But, yeah, you're right. We should have that conversation, somebody representing the city and where its future is. Maybe Mayor Chapman would be a good person to go to.
Made the accusations about the Sarasota Police Department.
That's
that
right.
They don't have any stringent requirements to hire an officer.
Well, I can bring that up, sure.
The Sarasota Police Information Officer should be able to answer that question.
Well, when you talk to the people on the top, oh, no, we do it all right. They fill out the forms. They have to pass the tests and so on and so forth. But when you talk to people who work as clerical people, they'll tell you that in practice it's another ballgame. So I'd rather have it coming out of the mouth of the mayor, and she should know. It's her job to know and defend or protect or eliminate or whatever they're going to consider doing. But they have discussed it in chambers to eliminate that whole force because the budgets are so difficult for them these days. Last year they got rid of the parking meters. They spent millions of dollars to put them in. Then they took them all out. They put in a red light system that they've had to cut the fees in half of their charging people. Lots of ups and downs and reversals within the city of Sarasota Police. So we can talk and ask that question, and we can get the mayor, or we can get somebody representing the hiring practices, and do they ever come into question. But the behavior of some of these police is amazing, and they get caught on videos, they get caught in person and witnessing lots of different situations that have to be an embarrassment to Ms. DePino that this is what's going on in Sarasota County.
Well, on the other side of the world, President Obama, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and U.S. President Barack Obama announced Sunday they have reached an agreement to break the deadlock that has been stalling a civilian nuclear power pact for 6 years. The 2008 accord between the two countries was held up by U.S. concerns over India's laws on liability in the event of a nuclear accident. I am pleased that 6 years after we signed our bilateral agreement, we are moving to commercial operation consistent with our laws and international legal obligations, the Prime Minister Modi said at a joint press conference. And he broke protocol. He actually met President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama at the airport just to welcome him. He was so excited.
Isn't that interesting? Here you have the leader of a country of a billion-plus people moving toward 2 billion rapidly, and probably one of the more educated countries overall historically, but with infrastructure struggling and lots of other problems and corruption running rife. That's the history. How do they bring that into turn? They're looking into China for what they've been able to do to streamline their government without losing their democracy. The rape systems that have been going on, the rape crimes of women who insult or embarrass the families, and the wholesale problem there, genitalia mutilation, all these very awful things that happen in India, which is supposed to be democratic. Modi's trying to deal with in a very quick and heavy-handed fashion. His parliament is beginning to scratch their head as to what kind of leader he is. So he's looking for validation, I think, with our president coming over there. So there's respect for Obama, absolutely, when he goes to the airport with that kind of representation behind him, especially now that Iran is on the table.
Well, speaking of Iran, it's interesting that we're making a deal to sell them billions of dollars worth of nuclear peaceful equipment.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a country with a nuclear bomb that hasn't signed the nuclear proliferation treaty, not a nuclear non-proliferation treaty. And but here we are all excited about being able to sell them more technology so that they can continue to expand their nuclear operations.
You know, the curious thing, Henry, tied in with this thing, is here he's meeting with the replacement Saudi that's coming in for his brother just dying, and he's about to go under the way things sound for his health. And he's making nuclear arrangements with possible ones with India. And on the agenda all this time and about to decide upon is the Rouhani-Obama situation with respect to Iran. And at the same time, there's discussion now that maybe we should back off of getting rid of Assad, because our success in eliminating leaders that are in place is worse than what replaces them in the form of a war or further embattlement and our involvement in that embattlement all over that whole area.
Well, I know that you have a topic you want to get to. Let me just quickly remind people, as you just did, President Barack Obama cut his visit in India short with all the success and the urgency to get to Saudi Arabia to pay his respects to the new King Salman. Islamic militants beheaded Japanese hostage after swapping for a remaining one. And ISIS sets up English-speaking brigade to large Western countries. That's via Russia Today, of all news sources. And Spanish police arrest four members of the ISIS terror cell. So lots of news on that front. But the one I really wanted to get to before we hit something, this is from Sky News. I talked about Russia
right.
Today. Sky News, the Rupert Murdoch news service in Great Britain, satellite TV service network, has this. Ukraine's bloody conflict against pro-Russian separatists in the east of the country has led to thousands of deaths. And it talks about their filmmaker Ross Kemp saw firsthand how militias made up of football hooligans and current former soldiers are now fighting on the front line. Senior members of the Azov battalion have now been given influential positions within Petro Poroshenko's government. That is our ally in that. Its commander, Andriy Belitsky, is believed to be in charge of two neo-Nazi political groups and has been elected to serve in Ukraine's parliament. And, of course, we are sending trainers to Ukraine to help these people against the Russian pro-militia groups. But here we have Rupert Murdoch's British news service. I didn't see it on Fox for some strange reason.
They're running into problems.
Saying the same thing that Harley Schlanger and the LaRouche people have been saying for over a year, that they're neo-Nazis.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, confrontation is on the horizon over there, and Putin is in such trouble financially, he's got to distract the people from their highly inflationary, devalued, deflationary ruble. And Harley's going to be a real projection of what's about to come, I'm afraid, and it's not going to be good. And we're going to get entangled in some fashion or other, or drug in some way or other, with the confrontation in Ukraine over what happens with the gas, natural gas going to Europe, what happens with the whole mess in Ukraine. Is Ukraine going to be taken over by the Russian military, or have they been taken over by the Nazi element? I mean, that's going to be the apparent contest, Henry, I think, and it's going to be the one that's going to caricature thing. And this latest turnout of in Iowa under Mr. King with the runs running for
office. Now, who is he?
Mr. King, his first name escapes me right at the moment.
Representative?
Representative in Iowa who's got, let's see, Mr. Trump is going to run for president. Mr. Santorum is going to run for president. You got, but no show up of Bush or Romney or even Rand Paul didn't show up.
Sarah Palin says she's seriously interested in the 2016 campaign.
Really, it's lipstick on a pig, you know. Maybe she knows something about the pigskin situation with the football circumstances.
Well, she had quotes on that, too.
Did she?
Yeah, that they were dealing with deflated balls in Washington also.
Oh, she did say something like that.
Yes. If you want to put lipstick on a pig, there's plenty of pigs out there in Iowa. And if she can't find him, I'm sure Joni Gersh, the new senator from, Kansas?
You know, and the way they're
Iowa.
Now, they're going to get caricatured as putting lipstick on the pigskin itself and whatever else. I mean, you know, but it leads into euphemisms that you may not want to go to. But Joni Ernst is going to be a factor, and Mr. King seems to be the happy as a clam that he has the turnout he has. And who was it that attacked Romney and Bush in the process? I don't know if they attacked Rand Paul or not, but one of the
I don't know, but Charles Krauthammer, one of your Fox News favorites, said he's picking Marco Rubio for the Republican presidential nomination.
Isn't that interesting? You're going to split the vote so much so that Rubio would slide into it.
You can say these things over a year out, so because nobody will remember, because you've said a few other predictions by then. Yeah. Well, Augie, why don't you get into the topic that you wanted? I'll get Dennis Mealy on the phone, and then we'll play a little bit more about Governor Rick Scott and figure out how we're going to overcome the technical issues here in the studio.
All right. Well, Paul Krugman is saying that Europe, what went wrong, and right now it's really showing up. The Germans are going to have to do what we did for them, what they're going to have to do for Greece. And the difference in attitudes is the main reason that the two economies, ours and Europe's, are now on such different pathways. Spendthrift, loose money America is experiencing a solid recovery, a reality reflected in President Obama's feisty State of the Union. Meanwhile, virtuous Europe is sinking ever deeper into deflationary quagmire. Everyone hopes that the new monetary measures announced Thursday will break down the downward spiral, but nobody I know, this is Krugman, really expects them to be enough. Europe, what went wrong? On the U.S. economy, now it's good morning. Well, not exactly morning in America, but good morning in America, perhaps. Let alone the kind of prosperity we managed during the Clinton years. Recovery could and should have come much faster, and family incomes remain well below their pre-crisis level, although you'd never know it from the public discussion. There's overwhelming agreement among economists that Obama stimulus of 09 and 10 helped limit the damage from the financial crisis. It was too small and faded away too fast. Still, when you compare the performance of the American economy over the past 2 years with all those Republican predictions of doom and gloom, you can see why Mr. Obama is strutting just a bit. And, of course, he did that at the State of the Union, and there he said he was coming to the end of his term, and he got cheering at that point. But he says, I won the last two, didn't I? On the monetary side, officials fought the imaginary menace of inflation. It took years to acknowledge that the real threat is deflation. This is regarding the European situation. Europe is more precisely the Eurozone. The 18 countries sharing a common currency did almost everything wrong. And now they're faced with Greece and what's going to happen with Greece. Greece deserves what Germany received, the Marshall Plan and all the rest, having done far more damage as a country against the rest of the world than Greece has done in this situation. Small country needing a bailout of a major sort and a stimulus at the same time. They've now voted in leftward-leaning politicians who are going to bring in stimulus and get rid of austerity, and in the short run will probably blunt some of that. But how effective they're going to be is the real question. The terrible thing is that Europe's economy was wrecked in the name of responsibility. True, there have been times when being tough meant reducing deficits and resisting the temptation to print money. In a depressed economy, however, a balanced budget fetish and hard money obsession are deeply irresponsible. Not only do they hurt the economy in the short run, they can in Europe and have inflicted long-run damage, damaging the economy's potential and driving it into a deflationary trap that's hard to escape. And that is the problem. Europe is now paying the price for their self-indulgence for years and perhaps decades to come. So, Henry, we have our...
Well, we do, but we're going to go ahead and play a clip from Governor Scott being asked questions just a couple days ago from the Capitol Press Corps about the issue that Dennis Mailey, editor of the BradentonTimes.com, is going to address us on, and then we're going to figure out how to overcome the technical issues here in the studio while that plays. So here comes Governor Scott with his latest on the Gerald Bailey FDLE scandal.
We're having trouble with that, too. Huh?
Bailey, for his service, he resigned.
Why did you want to change at the top of FDLE?
Well, I want to thank Commissioner Bailey for his service. He resigned. I picked Commissioner Swearingen, approved today by the cabinet. He's going to do a great job.
If I may say, most respectfully, sir, if I may say, you know, we know, Pete Antonacci went to FDLE and told Jerry Bailey retire or resign. He was forced out of his job. He did not resign voluntarily. Would you agree with that, sir?
I'll tell you that Commissioner Bailey did a great job. Commissioner Swearingen is going to do a great job. The cabinet approved him today. We're at a 43-year low in our crime rate. We're going to continue to make sure this is safe that people want to live in because it's safe.
But with all due respect, sir, don't you think these taxpayers in the state of Florida deserve an answer as to why you, the chief executive, would feel the need to replace the head of such an important agency? Why wouldn't you answer the question, sir?
Again, I can tell you, say it again. Commissioner Bailey did a great job. We have Commissioner Swearingen. He's going to do a very good job. I'm thankful the cabinet approved him today. We're going to continue to work to make sure this is the place that you want to raise your families because it's a safe state. 43-year low in crime rate. Law enforcement across the state is doing a great job. As you know, a week and a half ago, I did a proclamation for first responders. I'm proud that today we had some students here that did send some letters to our first responders because they're doing such a great job.
All right, that was Governor Rick Scott speaking to the Tallahassee Press Corps, just so people know what's going on here, because it's going to sound a little bit different. Even though Augie and I are so unlike us to talk about technical issues in the studio, our audio feed does not work, at least to both of us, while Dennis Mailey is talking. So there'll be a certain separation between our conversations here. Please bear with us because Dennis has some very important information to talk about, as he always does, because he's the editor of the BradentonTimes.com. You can see his column online Sunday and Thursday, but you don't have to go looking for it because you can sign up for their email newsletter that'll feed it to you daily, weekly, semi-weekly, whatever you want. Good morning, Dennis. How are you today?
Dennis. Good morning. Thanks for having me, Henry.
Hi.
Well, how you doing?
Yeah, we're doing very well considering the circumstances. Now, we want to get into the issue that you wrote about in your Sunday column, and that was that we need to get off the dime on this scandal, but I'm going to let you go ahead and tell the audience. Give us the background of the scandal as you see it and the points you were trying to make in that column.
Well, the main problem is that there seems to have been an obvious circumvention of process. Now, Rick Scott and his administration has made comments to indicate that, yes, you know, this was a sort of asked-for resignation. So anyway, if you want to slice it and we look at Gerald Bailey's statements, he's claiming very intensely that he was fired. He was pushed out. He was told he didn't have a choice and that this was what was going to happen. There's a problem with that. There's a prescribed process. State statute, you know, going all the way back to the 60s, says that can only be done. Agency heads can only be hired or fired, especially fired, by a vote of the cabinet. And there's a reason for this. You don't want any one particular official, especially a governor, having that much power where they can put political puppets into important positions, especially the FDLE. You're talking about something that has policing power. So, I mean, there's potential for abuse here. So it's very important that when you look at, you know, this process, it's there to have the separation so that, hey, if you're going to get rid of somebody, we're going to make it public. We're going to have during a public meeting of the cabinet, you know, the reasons are going to have to be aired, and you're going to have to make a case for getting rid of them, and you're going to have to get the entire cabinet to agree with you. It has to be a unanimous vote. If you can't do that, the person's going to stay. So it kind of creates this environment where you want to hire the right person and you want to separate politics from the actions. And it looks here like, at a minimum, before you go into the more serious accusations, which you can talk about, but at a minimum, let's say that he did have reasons, which, again, he hasn't really given any at all. If he did have reasons, Governor Scott, to want to get rid of Gerald Bailey, there is a prescribed process to do that, and he seems to have circumvented it.
Dennis, I just want to jump in here for a second. Augie went into deep meditation and prayer and managed to revive his microphone so he can hear you and talk at the same time. It's like the first time he ever walked and chewed gum at the same time.
There you go, Dennis. Hey, it's great to hear from you, Dennis. And Mr. Bailey and Bondi and some of these people are really looking at this thing as, we got a guy in here who marginally won his election, who's not really popular even after the fact that he's elected, and the party can't look at him as someone who makes these kinds of problems, reminds people, has to remind people who know anything about his Fifth Amendment abuse of 75 times and the scandal that he came from in his days in the medical business.
Well, yeah, all right, so you go one step further. So we start with the fact that if he was indeed pressured to resign, we really had the state law having been broken. That's a problem, even if, like I said, there is an issue that we have not been made aware of with Mr. Bailey. Now, let's say, for example, there's another thing to it. Let's say Mr. Bailey, and this is completely in the hypothetical, let's say he did do something wrong. Let's say he was part of some scandal. There's, again, a problem, because you don't, again, pressure him into resigning. The public, I think, has a right to know that. You know, if an FDLE chair, you know, did do something worthy of being dismissed for it, we should know what that is. What if it has to do with other cases or other people's rights that, you know, what if it casts a cloud over different things? Again, there's a whole lot of reasons why that's supposed to be public. But all we've heard, now this is a guy who's had a sterling record for 10 years. This is a guy appointed by Jeb Bush, served through three administrations, and really had, you know, as good of a resume as you can have. And he's claiming, hey, there were some political reasons for this. You know, I was asked to give rides and details for people in Governor Scott's campaign during the election in 2014, and I spoke up and said, listen, that's not, you know, you and your staff, and that's it. That's the way the law works. He also said that he was directed to target a clerk of the courts when there was that prison outbreak, and you know, they used forged paperwork to escape from a prison. So, you know, and he said, you know, this person doesn't seem to be involved in any way. This doesn't lead back to them. I feel like I'm being pressured to kind of muddy them up a little bit. So, you know, you have a couple of things in there that just you know, don't pass the smell test. And then, you know, my point really is the cabinet needs to be doing more. You know, there was a little bit. You had, bring up the speed of listeners, last week on Tuesday, you had Jeff Atwater, the CFO of the state, one of the cabinet members, send a pretty, you know, strong-worded letter to Governor Scott, you know, voicing his disappointment and how he thinks there should be a new process and we should reopen the application for, or excuse me, the review for a replacement. And Governor Scott basically said, yeah, okay, but no. And, you know, really shot him down and let her back. And then Atwater kind of was quiet after that, you know, kind of accepted, you know, Scott's refusal of it. Now, once Atwater had spoken, and, you know, the political background of this is that there's, you know, pretty much, it's pretty well understood that he's looking at a possible gubernatorial run next time out. So once that was struck, then other members of the cabinet really had to respond a little bit more forcefully than they had. So you had Agricultural Commissioner Adam Putnam sent, you know, a letter saying, hey, you know, here's some ideas I have on how we can have a better process for hiring or removing, a multi-step process for doing this with more transparency. Governor Scott was kind of like, yeah, some of those things look good, maybe we can talk about it later. really kind of blew him off. And then you just had Pam Bondi. Now, remember, now, these are the four members. You have the governor, you have the CFO, you have the ag commissioner, and the fourth member is the AG, the attorney general. This is the person, though, that should be most concerned, given that it's a potential legal issue. If the governor broke the law, it's your attorney general is the person that should be policing that. And she had the softest kind of, it should be a public process, and I look forward to talking about it at the next cabinet meeting out in the open. So really a weak response from the entire cabinet, who, again, this is one-party rule, they're all Republicans, and outside of Atwater's strongly worded initial letter that he quickly backed off of after Scott's response, there hasn't been much noise at all by the cabinet. Now, some of the left-leaning media outlets have blown this up and said, oh, there's a power struggle and on Capitol Hill, and the cabinet's, digging into each other. And the reality is that's not the case. You know, the reality is, what can they do? They obviously can't endorse it and say good for Governor Scott if he fired him. They have to, condemn it to some degree, but I think they've done it in the softest kid glove, most quick glove approach that you possibly can take. And I think that is where the people have to expect a little more. Obviously, the governor's dug in his feet. And, yeah, like Augie pointed out, this really seems to speak to that CEO mentality of I'm the boss. If you're not with me, I'll replace you. We do things my way or you pack up your bags. But that's not the way the Florida Constitution is set up.
And he seems to be putting that in question. The one thing that Bondi's quoted in is in a statement this week. This is, I guess, it came out of Miami. The business that she is looking into and making serious questions concerning the circumstances about Mr. Bailey's departure and the quick appointment of his successor. But then he says, Mr. Bailey, that the governor asked him to intercede in out-of-state money laundering investigation on a donor who the governor wanted to appoint to a state board, Governor Scott.
Yes, that's another one. So you have another issue we had, I believe the incident was in Arizona or someplace out west. It was in California. And so you had a big-time donor who was going to get appointed to a board. I think it might have been Enterprise Florida, though that might not be correct. And he was under a cloud because there was an investigation that was wrapped up, and he basically, asked him if he could kind of look into this and maybe bring it to a conclusion. And, again, so these are parts of a series of issues where Bailey said, here were some political things where I felt my office was being kind of pulled in a certain direction or at least pointed in the way that it was supposed to go. And, he wasn't comfortable with that. And he really felt like he got the message that, look, if you're not comfortable with doing things like this, then you might not be the right guy for this spot. And I don't think Bailey thought anybody would have the audacity to say, he's sitting there thinking, I'm the head of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. You can't really tell me I have to politicize the office or else there is nowhere else. You'd have to get the whole entire cabinet together and they'd have to, vote to remove me and, the public backlash for not having a reason. What are you going to tell them? Because I'm not political enough? I'm not supposed to be political. So I think Bailey was shocked when, Governor Scott showed the audacity to say, hey, you're gone. But let's just, again, I can't stress this enough. Let's just even imagine there's something we don't know. Because some people have brought, I think the most disappointing part about it is the response I get is obviously Democrats are going to jump over Scott. That's to be expected. But the Republican response has largely been, one, well, we don't know what's happened. What about that? What if Bailey's dirty? What if something? And again, there's the problem. So even if let's assume the worst is possible, the problem is there's a public process for this for a purpose on both ends. Whether he's being unfairly butchered for not being political, or whether he's being protected and given the opportunity to resign instead of being fired publicly, both of those things are wrong, and that's why the process exists. Because if he did something wrong in that position and deserves to be gone, the public and anyone who might be then involved or somehow in, something they had with the FBLE that may be in cast in question because of that, whatever the case is, the public has a right to know. And if he was dismissed for political reasons, then the public certainly has a right to know and certainly has a right to be very upset about it. So there is... The onus is on Governor Scott at this point to answer clearly, not with that you know, obfuscation that you heard in that interview that clip that Henry played in the beginning, where he basically dances around in circles about who did a good job, who's going to do a good job over and over and over again. But he needs to come clean on why this gentleman was dismissed, what the circumstances were, and then the cabinet needs it. You know, if this process wasn't followed, which that seems to be the one clear thing that hasn't happened, is that the state statute and the process described in it was not followed. For better or worse, or whatever reason, it was not followed, and there needs to be corrective action taken, and only the cabinet can make that happen. And they don't seem to be really motivated at this point to do any more than make some, you know, public statements that they think are adequate.
Well, they can't even seem to keep their story straight on the staff level, Dennis. On Thursday, Governor Scott's office released a two-page letter explaining and pushing back against the Bailey accusations. And in the letter, it said that the December 16th letter from Bailey, he, quote, stepping down. Well, the problem is that's not what it said. The Bailey quote accurately would be he would no longer serve as an executive director of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. There was nothing about resignation, nothing about stepping
right
down. And a Scott spokesman, Jackie Schultz, said that it was a typo in the letter. That's quite a typo from how do you hit about 16 wrong keys?
That's the original statement that Scott made, and the first time they acknowledged that wasn't completely correct. You know, it again, you have the fact remains either he willfully resigned of his own volition, which he is adamantly denying, or the governor circumvented the legal process for dismissing a department head. One of those two things happened. And whatever else happened around it or has to do with it are all secondary to that. Because, again, you start with a constitution, you start with state statutes, and you say, we're a state of laws, and we are the people that are at the top of that state, designed with approving the laws and designed with enforcing the laws. But we're not doing it uniformly and not when it doesn't fit our agenda, then there's a real big problem with law and order in the state. So as far as I'm concerned, you have those two things. So either Gerald Bailey is lying and he really did resign of his own volition and was not coerced or pressured in any way, and he just completely made this up for some unfathomable reasons, or else the state law and process was circumvented, and that is a problem.
Dennis, there are a couple of peripheral things here. First of all, it's mentioned that Bailey was appointed under the Jeb Bush administration, and he is going to be looking to Florida for support should he go further with his effort for the presidency. And then at this same time, we've got Judge Lewis about to make a decision or push the legislature into doing the redistricting thing all over again. And these are kind of converging, competing elements of what this leadership of this governor and its legislature are really all about.
Yeah, and there could be some more Machiavellian reasons for Bailey to fall on the wrong side of Scott's graces, but the reality is Scott's really indicated a lot to his actions that just the things that Bailey said, and that's the problem for Scott, unless he comes out with a factual, verifiable narrative that supports this. It fits this impression people get. I don't think there are too many people, Republican or Democrat, who can't really imagine Governor Scott looking at this and saying, okay, yeah, we need to get rid of this guy just because he won't play ball. He won't, I'm the governor. I should be able to, if I want these details in my campaign, you know, what's the big deal? You know, if I want him to target an investigation on the clerk of the court, that's what he should do. I'm the CEO, I'm the governor. You know, so I don't think it even has to go deeper than that. And then it should also be noted that in his response to CFO Atwater, Governor Scott actually said, I actually want some more dismissals. I think we have some more changes that could be made. So he's looking really to shuffle the deck. And then in one of his response statements in the question about Bailey, he said something to that effect. That's something you do. You move people in and out of these things. It's not good to have them, you know, there for too long. Change is good. Turnover is regular. Those kind of things. That those all kind of speak to, that history that you spoke of earlier. So I don't think anybody, I think history, Governor Scott's reputation, the things that he's done in the past, I think they all, again, serve to put more of the burden on him to come up with some very good reasons for why what seems to be a complete lack of respect for state law and a prescribed process is something other than what appears to the public.
Dennis, there's a lot going on besides this that shows a division within the Republicans there, and that's the recent picking of their head of the GOP, because there seems to be some recriminations from Rick Scott because his handpicked choice,
Leslie didn't get in.
Dower didn't get in. So he's withdrawn his money that he gave to the state Democratic Party. And then also Republican Party, thank you. The Senate Victory Political Action Committee withdrew $800,000from the party. So who was backing the Chairman Blaise Ingoglia's victory?
What you look at here is nobody really has a good understanding of what Governor Scott's long-term plan is. A lot of people thought, you know, he's just going to try to be as influential for his own interests in the second term and try to get a lot of things changed in terms of taxes and corporate regulation that will benefit a person with interests like his in the future and the friends of people like his. Why he was so interested in the influence and control in the Republican Party, then people started asking, hey, is he looking to be a player in Florida politics as the next governor? Is he looking to really get into that Republican establishment in a way he's never really done and to be a long-term influence in Florida Republican politics? I think that was not something that people were thinking was likely, at any point up to now in the last 6 years, because he's always kind of been an outsider and never really accepted by that real Florida Republican establishment. And then there's still the part, the whispering going on behind the scenes that Governor Scott has presidential ambitions. And it's absolutely absurd, as that might seem to any, political out there, that a guy who has never been able to get a majority of votes in his own state, has never crossed the 50% threshold, has never been able to have an approval rating, that is anything higher than embarrassment, would actually look then to mount a national campaign. I mean, and if anything, it's always a constant race between him and Scott Walker over who is the Wisconsin governor, over who is, the most loathed government nationally. They're some of the view that get Rick Perry, those three, and maybe Christie, are four governors who get national headlines. And in Scott's case, they're always negative. He's never gotten positive ones outside the state of
Dennis,
Florida. So if he has presidential ambitions, that would be shocking. But that might feed into it. I don't know.
Dennis, we're speaking with Dennis Maley. He's the editor of the BradenandTimes.com. Be sure to check out his columns on Thursday and Sunday, as well as all the other articles he puts up there, as well as his staff. And you sign up for their multi-frequency email newsletter that you can get as frequently as you want. Well, he's going to ride his personal charisma to the presidency, Dennis. I think that's obvious. Another governor with presidential ambition, Bobby Jindal. What about the influx of his staffers into Scott's staff? What does that mean?
The New Orleans crowd, what is that?
That is odd. And like I said, politics makes strange bedfellows. And when you have these alliances, and I guess that's one thing, too, that you're going to have to watch closely. Because I'd have a call come out this Thursday about the dynamics of Florida Republicans and how you're going to see the battle lines drawn in the camp ship. Because when you have Jeb Bush enter a presidential fray, then it's kind of like when a Clinton enters it. It's going to suck up a lot of money and a lot of kind of old guard support. And there's really going to have to be a lot of scrapping to get a place at the table. So you might see some strange alliances, because you look at some careers, there are a lot of people that, look, this time or the next time might be their last run. Would Bobby Jindal be looking seriously at a presidential run? Is he looking to line up maybe a less conventional support network, assuming that Jeb Bush will be able to get, the more obvious low-hanging fruit? I don't know. But I think some strange things will happen. And what's happening right now in Florida, which I'll talk a little bit more on in Thursday column, is you've got Senator Rubio's wild card kind of holding everybody up, because there's already starting to be some potential rumors that Rubio would be looking to run for governor in 2018. If Jeb Bush jumps into the presidential race.
Well, he, with the character we have as governor currently, should he decide to distract the public with a run for the presidency, would make things really, really interesting. I mean,
well, that's interesting, Dennis, and we're out of time, but I have to say that although I would disagree with his policies, I bet Marco Rubio would, considering, wasn't he Speaker of the House?
Yes, he would have a great chance at governorship, and he would have a very poor chance at getting the Republican nomination. And he'll have, but that'll have a lot of trickle-down effects, because then you'll have Nelson coming up that same year, so you'll have other people deciding, like Atwater and Putnam, whether or not they're going to go after Rubio and look for that Republican nomination for governorship, or whether they're going to go and run for the Senate that year, because it's unlikely at that point he'll be, I believe, well into 76 or something. So you'll have there's really a lot of dynamics, and the reality is that seems a long way off for us, but when you're lining up tens of millions and even hundreds of millions of dollars, you've got to start getting your feet wet now.
Yep. Dennis Maley, the editor of the BradenandTimes.com. We're out of time, Dennis. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, there you have it. We got a governor that knows term limits when he sees them and decides where they should be applied, and the devil take the hindmost.
All right. We'll be back Wednesday for another Morning Edge. And I guess tomorrow at this time slot, it's your gavel with Mitch Mallett and Terry Wonder. You just have to tune in to find out.
It'll be a wonder.